So in the first talks of this retreat, we offered you a version of the 16 steps of Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. And this practice of Anapanasati, of focusing on the breath, attention to breathing, is a time-honored practice in Buddhism. And Buddhism in China and Japan and Tibet and all over, mindfulness of breathing was a very popular practice. It's possible it's the most popular meditation practice in Buddhism, most common one. And many teachers have held it up as being so effective that it can be the only practice that you do. And Richard pointed out to me the other day that in the suttas, it seems to be that the only practice the Buddha, meditation practice the Buddha describes himself as doing, he might have done others, but the only one as a Buddha that he practiced was mindfulness of breathing. So I thought what might be nice, given its great value, is to review it, go over it again. And probably every time someone reviews it or goes over it, it's a little different, because it's a wonderful template, it's a wonderful kind of outline for practice that can be interpreted, understood, or practiced in different ways. And probably, you know, just as different teachers will teach it differently, so probably over time, if you do this practice, it changes for you as well over time. One of the ways that the goal of Buddhist practice is described is in terms of the individual who practices it. And one way is when you mature in this practice, you become independent in the Dharma. Independent in the Dharma, meaning that in the Dharma, in the truth, in the practice, in freedom, that you know it, and you know the practice, and you know yourself well enough that you don't have to rely on teachers, texts. You don't have to rely on something else for your safety, for your freedom, but you have the ability to dwell independent in the Dharma. In a certain kind of way, to be, I don't know if self-reliant is the right word, but when I was in Japan practicing, I asked a Zen teacher there, when was a person ready to receive Dharma transmission? Dharma transmission means that you're now, you get transmitted the Dharma so you can teach it to others. It's kind of a ritual and recognition that now you're ready to be a teacher. And this teacher responded to me and said, when the person can stand on their own two feet. I thought that was a nice answer. Kind of be able to, certain kind of self-reliance. Again, this idea of not needing to lean on something else, be supported by something else. And as a description of the direction we're going, but it's useful, I think important to see it as where we're going, because we do need a lot of support. And we have Sangha for support, we have the refuges for support, we have teachings for support. But we use those supports not as the permanent support, but as the temporary supports that gives us a strength, teaches us, informs us, helps us understand ourselves better, opens us up, settles us, whatever the word's meaningful for you, so that you can become independent in the Dharma. You can stand there on your own two feet. And for some people, that means that there's no more reason to explain yourself to someone. Some people always want to explain themselves, or to defend yourself, or to justify yourself, or to hide yourself from others. That's some people's preferred thing, you know, that I don't want to be seen. There's no more need to, one of the more kind of provocative definitions for enlightenment, being enlightened, that I heard once, was when you're enlightened, someone asked, well, how do you know when someone's enlightened, or what is it to be enlightened? And this monk said, if you're enlightened, you have no more reason to complain. Isn't that nice? Now you don't want it. No complaining. There must be some kind of prison. And so then we have these 16 stages. And Richard spoke very beautifully about seeing these both as a path and as a non-path. We want to just show up and be fully here. And in doing that, we're also involved in an unfolding. Things change, and things change in a kind of pattern or lawful way. And if you completely are here in a full way without trying to do anything, become anything, attain anything, that is never going to be static. That sets in motion certain conditions that will unfold. And those conditions to unfolding can be quite profound. And in fact, one of the ways that the unfolding of practice was described in these ancient texts is, an analogy for it was that of a river water flowing down a river, starting a little teeny stream high in the mountains, joining other streams, becoming bigger, rivers joining, and eventually making it into the ocean. The idea it's all downhill from here. We're flowing down, and rather than the image of, you know, you have to trudge up the mountain, it's so hard to get up to the top, and the image is that rather of almost like a natural process that we enter into, and then as we practice, we're carried along. Now, if it does feel like it's uphill battle, uphill climb, that's okay. Sometimes it is that way. But it's also sometimes at some point we enter into a kind of this stream of practice. It's called the stream enterer. We enter the stream and it carries us along. So these anapanasati, and one of the things that's very nice about it is it does provide a kind of a sequence of unfolding. And it doesn't have to be an unfolding that happens sequentially, but it's suggestive of a path. It's suggestive of a kind of trajectory that we follow. And it can be, I think it's reassuring to have a map, to have a sense that there is an unfolding. People know what it is. People are familiar with it. And so that when we start entering this path, we can trust it. Because the various things that can happen are known and understood. They're kind of like maps. Some of the things that can happen can be challenging and difficult, but those are known. You know, chances are pretty high that if you're having some difficulty in your practice, that chances are high that you have not managed to figure out a completely, uniquely, creatively new way of suffering. Chances are, I mean, certainly, you know, your particular, all the conditions that come together may be unique, but, it's not that, you're probably not that creative to figure out a brand new human way of suffering. It's known. This world of the heart, the mind is known. And there are people who've walked this path ahead of you, they've studied it, they've taught it, there are maps that are written. And I find it very, very reassuring. And so these 16 stages is part of this map. Someone practiced, and then at some point they were able to look back at how their practice unfolded. And they said, this sequence happened. And generally, one of the ways these sequences of unfolding happen is that we tend to go from the most obvious and coarse, big experience of life. And as we settle down, it gets more and more refined. I think I said earlier this analogy of if you're walking fast, that's the big thing you're doing. And then And you can take, you know, then you can start walking slow. But if you want to relax more, then you stand. If you want to relax more, then you sit down. And then if you want to relax more, you lay down. So there's a kind of an unfolding from high energy state to a kind of lower, calmer state. So this anapanasati kind of follows that pattern to some degree, where we start with what's most obvious. And I like the obvious because we don't have to be do. I spend a lot of time in practice trying to look for the subtle, the hidden. There must be some key, some secret. If I just bore down and find the right thing, and you know, it's this great spiritual tradition, Buddhism. So it must be something really special I'm supposed to notice. And it took me a long time to relax and just and learn to just be present for what's obvious, just what's here. But to do it with what's obvious in the present moment. And it doesn't have to be the body first, the breath first. But if you're sitting still in meditation, the largest movement that you're experiencing will be the breathing, unless you're, you know, swaying around a lot or something. And so you start with the movement which is most obvious, the physical activity is most obvious, the breath. And then we start paying attention to it. And use it as a place to enter the present moment, to train ourselves to be here in the present. And as we said, for some people the breath doesn't work as a good object. So it's fine to do other things. But for this one we start with breathing. So the breath becomes a training ground for slowly, the slow process of training the mind to let go of all its concerns and all the activities and spinning around and reaching forward and backwards. And it helps the mind to relax, to calm down. And we know that, I mean, because I think oftentimes if people are having panic attacks or some dramatic things going on, their instructions are breathe deeply as a way of kind of relaxing. A friend of mine, who's been a Zen student for many years, was doing work on the roof of the Zen Center's barn, garage, and broke his arm. And so the paramedics came to get him, and he was laying there in pain on the ground. The paramedics looked down at him, and they told him, "Breathe deeply." And he looked at me and he rolled his eyes. So it's, you know, you don't have to come here for Richard and I to tell you that. Breathe. So we start there. And then the instructions is very interesting. It says to experience, some translators translate as be sensitive to your whole body. I mean, what a lovely thing. Your body. You know, I hope it's lovely. This idea of connecting to yourself through your body, this body that's carried you around and done all these things for you, and body which is an organ of sensations and has its own intelligence, its own way of relating to the world, and has carries so much information about ourselves, but picks up things from the environment. And so we start tuning into this body. It's a very respectful thing to do. Just get to know your body better. And it doesn't say to change your body or have a better body or, you know, work out, get buff. Or, you know, it just says, and experience it from the inside out. And one of the exercises that's sometimes offered in this kind of setting, and I'll tell you the exercise, but I won't, you don't do it because I don't want to make things uncomfortable. And the exercise is to first remember all the things, ways in which you've thought about your body, maybe comparing to other people's bodies, and all the ways your body is somehow not quite right. You know, like I used to think my forehead was too high, and I spent an inordinate amount of time in middle school measuring the distance from my nose, like this, my finger, in class, right? And I can tell you very well, because I remember very well what the distance is, that it hasn't changed. My hair hasn't receded any. This was very important in middle school. And, you know, my hair is not long enough, or the hair is too short, or the hair is too this, or too that. I know people who think their hair is too straight. I know people who think their hair is not straight enough. You know, or this body part is too much, or this body part is too little, or this, you know, it just goes on and on, right? Noses and ears, and name your favorite thing. And so there's a lot of suffering around this. So just kind of don't do it, but the exercise would be, you know, remember those thoughts and tell yourself those thoughts again to yourself and what it was like, you know, to be that way. And then the exercise is to take a deep breath, let go, relax. And now, from the inside out, not thinking about your body, but feel and sense your body. How does your body experience itself? And then what's the difference between those two ways of experiencing the body? And from the inside out, most people will say, there's not a problem. From the inside out thing doesn't compare ourselves with other people. You know, the hair's too long, hair's too short. That's all about comparisons. And so the mind has to be thinking kind of from the outside in to make those comparisons. But from the inside out, your hair is quite content. Your hair doesn't have any problems. Whether it's gray or black or blonde or long or short or absent. That your hair doesn't have any problems. And so the different parts of your body, you know, your ears are too whatever. Your ears don't have any problems. It's, you know, nose, you name it, right? It's not, you know. So to experience and feel the body from the inside creates a very bit different context for relating to our body than if we experience it kind of from, I call it from the outside in, from our thinking and ideas and how it's supposed to be compared to others. And it can be a relief to put all those things down and take time to get to know your body from the inside out, just to feel it. And as we do this, as we settle in and breathe and show up in the present moment, if you notice that you're tense in your body, have a holding in your body, it's such a compassionate instruction. It says, relax. Isn't that nice? Those Buddhists are always into changing us and trying to get us somewhere. They're so goal-oriented. Okay, well, stay tense. So to relax. And each tetrad ends with something like relax or let go. So the beginning of the tetrad is preparing us, setting the groundwork for doing this important work of somehow releasing the places of holding or clinging or tension. And so this first one is feel the whole body. And then if there's tension or holding in the body, learn to soften, relax. I spent a few years, my early years of meditation, untraining myself. It's probably more likely to say it, untraining myself. I was trained to hold my stomach in because of my fear. So, you know, and so I would relax my belly. I could relax it. And half a second later, it would be tense again. And so that practice of learning to have a soft belly, it took a while. I had lots of time. And so I would just do it over and over again. And slowly, with time, then now it stays soft and relaxed. So it's an untraining from the way that we've trained ourselves, sometimes holding and clinging and gripping ourselves. So then it feels kind of good to have a soft, relaxed body, and hopefully begins to feel good to live inside a body that feels soft, that feels relaxed, that doesn't feel so tense all the time. And one of the places to have a higher quality relaxation in the body is in meditation. Not the first retreat you're on, or not necessarily right away, but slowly over time. Because here you can have slowly you can just keep moving in the direction of relaxing. In daily life, there's so many reasons to tense up and reinforce attention. So one of the places where I find the most relaxation in my body is on retreat. But usually it's not automatic, and usually what I have to, even to this day when I first show up at a retreat, after about a day or something, I start becoming aware, to my surprise usually, that I'm holding tension in my shoulders. I didn't think I was. If you'd asked me, I would have told you no. But you sit here quietly and kind of sit and kind of connect and, oh yeah, there's tension. And then maybe it takes another day for that, you know, that particular tension to kind of dissipate enough. I don't feel it anymore. So I'm just patient with it. That's how it is. And so it's just, you know, take your time and just show up and be present. But at some point it feels kind of good. It doesn't have to be dramatically good to be present in your body, to be in the present moment and not thinking about the franchise tax board or whatever, and just here. And so the instructions are to be sensitive to or to experience that joy, that delight, that sense of goodness that's there with that. And I like this a lot, that the instructions include being sensitive to this. And this was something that I didn't understand for many years, because I was introduced to Buddhism through Zen. And in Zen, you were just supposed to be there. You're supposed to kind of show up and sit and just sit. And anything extra was considered too much, you know, just. And so, just. And it, you know, and the idea that you would be sensitive and register and take in good feelings, I mean, that was, you know, that's hallmark Zen. You know, you know, that's, you know, that's not really the real thing. The real thing is, you know, I never thought this, but probably the real thing is only if you suffer. Then it's real. So it took me a while in the Theravada tradition to learn this thing that, yes, it's actually useful to take in the good feelings and be nourished by them, take them, feel them. And even if they're quite mild, and just take them in. Being very careful not to get attached, very careful not to have expectations always supposed to be there, and don't feel despair if they're not there. But just, you know, but when they're there, be nourished by it. So that, and be sensitive, experience it. And if you allow yourself to experience it as you breathe in and out, sometimes they can grow. It gets stronger and fills you more. So that's nice. So it's, you know, you connect it to yourself in a nice way. And then the instruction is on that as a kind of a foundation. Then you're ready to start noticing your mental activity. What goes on in your mind. And I love it that it's after doing this settling in and after having some modicum of well-being that we get to notice that we're neurotic. Some of us. Or, you know, or that they're just, you know, it's a little bit. It's, you know, it's usually not 100% flattering what goes on in there. You know, you could imagine that, I mean, this is what Joseph Goldstein once said, that he would imagine, he's sitting and meditating in the meditation hall, he'd imagine that all his thoughts and mental activities were projected on a screen in front of the meditation hall for everyone to see. And I think that helped him. It kind of took the trance or the sense of importance out of them, and, you know, or specialness. And so at some point we start becoming more sensitive to this, and probably you already are, even before you meditate, that's why you're here. But I like this idea that you know, that you're just going to do your practice and, you know, in simple, ordinary way and develop a foundation. And then when there's some foundation of some kind of well-being, this is the ideal at least, then you become aware of your mental activities. And to me, it was very meaningful that it says, just know your mental activities. It doesn't say know and judge, or know and feel it should be differently, or know and congratulate yourself. Just know. And I think this is where we start getting into the the idea of becoming independent in the Dharma, maturing and growing up in the Dharma, where we start really to understand ourselves, how we work, how our mental activities, our thoughts, how all this works, how our clinging works, how our resistance works, what are the cause and conditions for our suffering and problems. And this very honest and direct willingness to look and see how our mind works and see how we cling, how we suffer, is a hallmark of the strength of this tradition here. Because we want to grow up, we want to become independent. And you do that by understanding yourself well enough that you can take care of yourself, your own mind, your own mental activities, how you work. And you want to take your time with this. You want to take time to study how you cling, how you grasp. Take time to study how you are afraid. Take time to study how you have hate and aversion and judgments, and take your time. That's why I like it. That's why, you know, this is mindfulness of breathing in and out. Just keep breathing. Like in a yoga class, some of you have done yoga class where, one of the common instructions the teacher says, remember to breathe. You're holding your breath. Remember to breathe. So when you're meditating, remember to breathe. It kind of lubricates things. It's easier to take things lighter. Just see what goes on in your mind, mental activity. Do the study. Take your time. Breathe. So what it means in part is we are studying our clinging. We're becoming the patient student of our own clinging. And trying to avoid the spiritual bypass. It'd be nice if we can just go from here to there, in a very nice, pleasant way. But you don't really become mature unless you really see and understand yourself. So this willingness to turn and look at your mind and heart and see it for what it is, and to do it kindly, compassionately. I believe that it's generally pretty hard to be a human being. And most people have tremendous difficulties and challenges growing up and into their lives. And it sets the conditions for all kinds of strong emotions and feelings and thoughts and memories and concerns. And to meet that with kindness and compassion. But to meet it, to really see it. And we get to learn a lot about our mental activities. And it's a whole universe in itself. And one of the things is to appreciate what metaphors for practice work for you. There are different metaphors. Remember I told you the story of the two people who went to the Zen monastery at the same time, but they had opposite experiences there because of their background, right? So in early Buddhism, they had the idea of becoming a home leaver, someone who leaves home. And probably because someone back then, it's said in the text, home is a crowded, dusty place. So you ask yourself, what kind of home did that person grow up with? That a feeling, a really desirable thing is to be homeless. If you ask it that way, you can imagine, there were 32 kids and the parents were alcoholic and very strict, and they had to work from sunset to sunset. That, to work, and it was just like this oppressive place, and that's what home was. And so home leaving was like, this is great. The analogy I like to use is, they talk about renunciation is described in the text as being going forth into the open air, right, the open space. So imagine that you're snowed in all winter long in a one-room cabin with 32 of your relatives. You love your relatives perhaps, but 32 of them in one room for all winter long. And so finally, when the snow thaws and you can finally leave the cabin, it's like freedom, open air. So someone back in ancient India found it really meaningful, the idea of being homeless. When I was in my early 20s, I was a hippie. I hitchhiked around the country. it was, I had such a blast. I loved it. And I would have stand there on the road. My favorite place to hitchhike was from Santa Cruz up to San Francisco. I'd be disappointed if I got a ride too quickly, because I would just stand there with my thumb out, not really wanting a ride, but something, singing Janis Joplin, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to nothing left to lose." I would I was on the road, free, you know. To this day, being homeless that way, on the road, right? What could be better? And then other people, the metaphor that is meaningful for them is to be at home. And that also is metaphor has been very meaningful for me. Here, the idea would be that home is not an oppressive place, but home has associations of the place where you can relax and really be yourself and not have to worry about being something for someone or defend yourself or be threatened or prove yourself. It's the one place where you can just kind of, you know, you can go around in your undies or your pajamas and you can pick your nose and, you know, it's, you know, just kind of just be yourself and just not have to worry. Something that's just comforting to be at home. And so some people, this idea of that's a metaphor for spiritual practice. Come home. Come home. And come home to yourself and discover the home that's in your heart, the home that's here in your body. Not the physical home, but a spiritual home or a heartfelt home, just where you really feel that you can just be here, alive and well, and you carry your home with you. Or in the way that Richard talked about the circle, you can expand your circle of feeling home further and further. A number of you in my interviews talked about how meaningful that metaphor of expanding the circles was. So in some ways, this practice of anapanasati could be seen as letting go of what keeps you constricted and tight so that you can go forth and be free and fly like a bird. But some people get frightened by that metaphor. So it's just as well to let go of all the demands and concerns and constrictions you have so you can come home and rest here in your heart in the home of your heart. There's different ways of talking depending on the background, where we come from. So I mention all this because as we begin understanding our mental activities, our thoughts, we also start understanding where we come from, our conditioning, the images we use, the metaphors that we live by. And some of them are not so helpful for us. We live by metaphors that maybe are not useful. A simple one in meditation that's not useful, I believe. So at least at some point in meditation it's not useful. Is the metaphor that your mind wanders off and then you bring it back. Mind doesn't go anywhere. And where does it bring it back from? The idea of bringing it back, some people interpret that means jerk it back. You know, mind, come back. You know, or you come back to the breath, pounce on the breath. As if this portal of mind gets jerked around this way and that way. But in other metaphors, the mind just is. It doesn't move at all. It doesn't go anywhere. And rather than moving bringing the mind back, you just invite everything back to the mind. You invite the breath back in. Rather than pouncing, you know, going, taking the mind and pouncing on the breath, you open in the mind and welcome it back. So mental activity has a lot to do with the stories we tell ourselves, the images we use, the concepts we have, and we can have useful ones and not useful ones. And we could also relax it. And so the eighth step is relax those mental constructs, relax those mental activities. And in meditation, it's a really great laboratory, great arena to experiment and explore being different than how you usually are. And because when you're meditating, you don't have to think about, you don't have to think about the franchise tax board. You don't have to think about what happened in your high school prom. You don't have to think. There's a lot of things you don't have to think about. There's no requirement. It's a safe place to put these things down. It's a safe place to begin to trust calming the mental constructions, the mental activity down, not being so involved in thoughts, stepping away from the thoughts, not being so identified with your thinking, not think that everything has to be solved through thinking about it, but rather beginning to put thoughts down, relax around them. So the eighth step is to relax the mental activities. So relaxing the body is the coarse thing to do. Relaxing the mental activities is more refined. And not so easy to find that. It takes time to really find and understand how that works. So at some point, that's what we see. And then we come into the next tetrad, where it says, be aware of the mind, experience the mind. And how I understand that is be aware of the overall quality of your mental state, the mind state that you have. So not the particular activities within the mind state, but the mind state itself. And then to know that, let it be satisfied. I love the word satisfied. It doesn't mean it has to be pleasant. I think it's very satisfying for me to be present for what is true. One of my first Zen teachers, when he was introduced in college to Zen meditation, he said it was what hooked him to Zen and what kept him involved for a lifetime in Zen. He's now still a Zen teacher. Was that when he sat in Zazen, it was very painful for him. Which is, you know, you have to sit and not move in Zen. And he said for the first time in his life, he felt real. So you have to remember, maybe think where he came from. He was probably disconnected from himself, living in stories and concepts and that weren't really real. And somehow the pain brought him into reality. So I feel a bit sorry that that's what it took. But that's quite something to be. So it's very satisfying to connect with what's true. And then it says, concentrate or compose or unify. Settle yourself, steady yourself more deeply. This is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to begin to steady your being, steady the mind, steady the focus, steady your attention. Steady yourself on the breath, steady yourself in your body. The wavering, the wondering, the going this way and that, jumping around. Let it steady. Let it become steady. Find something that can be the ballast for your boat so your boat doesn't rock so much. Let the breath be maybe your ballast. Steady yourself in it. Lower yourself down into your breathing. And then experience, recognize, feel a liberated mind. When your mind state, at some point, sooner or later, you might begin having hints, intuitions even, of what it's like to feel a mind which feels free, that doesn't feel caught and contracted and preoccupied. And when that's available, that's more subtle still, right? You're going from more to less and less, more and more refined things. Appreciate that, feel it, be with it. And then the text says something very interesting, I think. The translation we're using says contemplate. The word is in Pali is anupassana, anupassati, which means, the word, it comes from the word passana, which means to see. It means to kind of see in a directed way or to look towards something. And so I like it. It doesn't contemplate in English sometimes means you think about it. Because the first thing is, you know, contemplate impermanence. You know, oh, great. Been letting go of my thoughts all these times. And now they tell me I get to think. I'll think about impermanence, what a great idea it is. But it's not thinking that contemplating, we're really observe impermanence. To notice how things are changing. It's a powerful thing to begin appreciating that our thoughts, our feelings, our experiences have a beginning and have an end. And it's powerful because it's very easy to be in the middle of the experience and succumb to what I call the delusion of permanence. You know, not that we think that it's going to be permanent, but we might operate as if. And I've been in a bad mood, and I know it's not going to last, but don't tell that to my mood. My mood operates as if this is it, you know. The story I like to tell is when we're having a very challenging time when my son was quite young, and you know, I was kind of like wit's end, and one day challenged, and my wife, we were kind of standing over my son and looking, you know, dealing with this whatever the drama of the moment, and my wife calmly looked up at me and said, "We're having one of those days." And I said, "Oh, it's just one of those days. It's not going to be here forever, it's just now." That made all the difference for me. So to begin appreciating, just one of those days, it's one of those sittings. I've had sittings where I sit down and retreat, and I say, "Oh, this is not what I'm hoping for. I had this really good sitting before. I expected to come back and have the same thing. But now I get cardboard breath. You know, just everything just feels achy and my mind doesn't want to settle, and just what a difference." And so I tell myself, "Oh, I'm having one of those sits. That's how it is now." There was a time when I used to fight it and struggle and thought there was something terribly wrong with me. I can tell you the gory stories. They're certainly not PG stories. You know, the suffering I had about beating myself up for just not being concentrated. One of the times I knew that I had made progress on retreat with my retreat practice. Oh, you know, finally, you know, measured progress. Now I know. Was I could get through a 7-day retreat and not get angry. Quite an attainment. And so, there's something about seeing the impermanence of things, the arising and passing of things, that's very meaningful. So sometimes the instructions at a retreat is at this point in the retreat, notice how things appear and disappear. And one of the fascinating things to notice is to notice the impermanent quality of your thoughts. Because you might be thinking about the same topic for the whole meditation. So there's a constancy in the topic, but you're probably not It's probably not just one continuous sentence with run-on words, you know, with no gap. There's probably, you're thinking about it, and then someone comes in and makes some noise, and you think about the person, you come back thinking about your important topic, and then something else happens, and think about that, and then you forget about your topic accidentally, and then after a while you remember, "Oh, I forgot," and you come back to this important thing, your high school prom, and whatever it is that you're kind of involved in. But it's not constant. It rises for a while, it's there for a while, it fades for a while, comes and goes. And there's probably little gaps. It's possible that you have the equivalent of a period after some of your sentences, and then two spaces. You know, you're supposed to have two spaces. You know, little gaps. So if there's a gap, if you can see there's a gap between your thoughts, even for a moment, you can ask yourself a very interesting, all kinds of interesting questions. One of the questions is, who am I when I don't use my thoughts to tell me? So if you have a sense of a gap where there's just a moment of no thoughts, in that space of no thinking, who are you if you don't have any thoughts to tell yourself who you are? Some people find there's a kind of, they're still alive, I'm still breathing, I'm here. What does it mean that you're breathing and here and not telling yourself a story? And what does it mean that after that little gap, a story begins, a thought arises? And how do you relate to those stories? So to see the arising and passing of stories, the arising and passing of ideas, is very, very, very powerful. And if we start kind of stepping back from and hold it much more lightly, these stories, life tends to go a lot easier. And so, as Richard talked about yesterday, then there's a fading away process, or a thin. I like the word thinning. Fading, it works, it's a good translation for the Pali, but I like the word thinning. So things get thinner. I used to look for the moment when my thinking would just finally stop. It was like the switch. But in fact, what happens for me, generally, as I practice and practice and practice, my thoughts get weaker and weaker, or more and more subtle, or thinner and thinner as we go along. And generally, as my thinking becomes more subtle and what I described as thinner, it feels more and more satisfying. More and more satisfying. Just so nice to have the quieting and thinning of the thoughts. And even if I had something really important I had to solve, some big issue I had to work through, at some point, what becomes more meaningful is the quieting, the thinning out of the thoughts rather than whatever I'm thinking about. It's so kind of peaceful, joyful, satisfying. Quieting and peacefulness. I don't disappear, I'm still here, but just this pleasant, abiding peacefulness. And the thinking and mental activities get thinner and thinner and thinner. And it just, the process of thinning out just feels so right. It feels so right to thin and get quiet. It's just like so, it's like desirable. It's like, yes. And it gets thinner and thinner. Until finally, the string breaks. There's a cessation. There's an end. And so then the 15th step in this Anapanasati is to observe, to be aware of cessation. And it might be the cessation of your clinging. It might be cessation of your concerns. There's many things that cease. And it's very helpful to take in the seizing of things. One that was very helpful for me in my retreats was that the idea that at some point I noticed that I was sitting meditating, and like a cat watching the mouse door, I was expecting to see that some difficulty I was having, some suffering I was having, something was going on, would stop. And there was this waiting, when is it going to stop? And then so many times, I'd go out, get up and go for a walking meditation, go for a meal or something and come back, and it was gone. I didn't see it disappear. And so I'm a slow learner, so finally I learned, stop waiting. Stop looking for it to happen. But when it does happen, appreciate it. Oh, look at that, it's gone. And then what is it like when it's gone? If you've been angry for a while and the anger goes, take the time to feel the cessation, the absence of the anger, what that's like. If you've been involved in fantasy for a long time and finally the fantasies stop, take it in and get to know that. Get to know yourself as now someone who's not having fantasy. What's that cessation like? And if there's all kinds of levels and degrees of cessation, and as it gets more and more refined, this meditation, then the cessations become more refined as well. And as we begin getting a sense of this impermanence, the thinning out, sense of the cessation, it's possible to be alive without some of the concerns we've been having all the time. A number of interesting things happen. One very interesting thing is that we realize we don't have to solve all our problems. Instead of solving them, they can dissolve. There's this whole beautiful process of the mind getting quieter, softer, malleable, steady, the mental activity is becoming quieter. Some of the concerns, knots in our minds that seem so important to solve, and maybe, the Gordian knot in our mind, we've carried this Gordian knot for our lifetime. It doesn't have to be a sword that cuts it through, but it's the warmth and care and compassion of our practice, of holding it kindly and just being present, that it just dissolves. And the problem doesn't, in a sense, doesn't go away, but it's no longer there in the mind. And I say that because I know for me and for many people, there's this kind of authority that we have to solve our problems. Sometimes we do, but maybe there's something more important to be done in meditation than solving the problems, at least in meditation, to let it all dissolve. Like a clump of sugar in water just dissolves. And then there's the relinquishment. And it's lovely, the word means, I don't know what, Richard gave a list of possible words, relinquishment, letting go, rejection even, it's kind of a strong word. And I don't know what it means in this early tradition exactly. But what I do know is that when we develop enough understanding about how some of this mental activity works and some of our clinging works, that at some point, we might, maybe because we let go of it temporarily, we've seen what it's like not to have it, that at some point we say, I'm done with that. I don't want to do that anymore. Enough of that. It could be that you spend inordinate amount of time watching television. And now for these days here, you haven't watched any television at all, and you survived. And when you go home, you say, now that I've been without television for 7 days, I see that I'm actually better off. I see the way television kind of numbs me. I had the cessation of television mind, and that was a good thing. I think I'm done with TV, done with that way of watching at least. There's something very mature, about recognizing that certain things we're involved in and doing don't serve us. And to say, I'm done, that's enough. Or to relinquish, to let go. And so I think it's a very important step, because you can let go of something temporarily, but the relinquishment is different than letting go. It's kind of like making a choice, like getting behind it, taking a stand. I don't know if that's the best example. I'm done with this. Enough of this. Enough of this kind of behavior. I've known people who said, enough of gossip. At the water fountain at work, there's all this gossiping. It's the currency at work. I've had enough. No more. And so, what might it be that, for me, at some point, a very important juncture in my practice was that I could see how much I was obsessed by, well, actually a number of points, but obsessed with my self-image and how people saw me. And I knew that I came to a point where I needed to let go, I wanted to let go of it. I was done, but I couldn't quite get behind it. I couldn't quite let it go. I felt done, enough of this. I had the wisdom, so it took a while to keep practicing. And another one was wanting people to like me. I was like completely into it. It's like my obsessed by wanting people to like me. And only when I saw how much suffering it caused me Was I, did I begin to let up, loosen up around this? So I'm, you know, I don't know if I'm done with that, but I kind of want to be done with being neurotic about people liking me. I would like people to like me. I think that's normal to have some basic desire for that, but it's, I don't care that much. I'll be fine if you don't like me. I'll be fine. So becoming independent of the Dharma, standing on our own feet, becoming mature in this practice. These 16 stages can be seen as one way of understanding this process of maturation, of growing up, of standing on your own, becoming independent. And it's a beautiful thing, because when you become independent, then you can meet another person more completely. If you're dependent, there's not enough space to meet, to see, to connect to someone. It's a very respectful thing to meet that way. Become independent in the Dharma. So finally, what's constant through these 16 stages, the constancy, the thread or the current that runs to the common denominator for all this, all 16 stages, is breathing in and breathing out mindfully breathing in and breathing out. And it can be so helpful to have something which is a constancy, constant reference, constant coming back, to carry it with you, this reference point, this support, this ballast, that if you can just stay with your breathing, It's the lubricant of life. Stay with your breathing and you're less likely to get lost and caught up in your thoughts and your concerns and your feelings. One of the themes of this practice, the constancy of staying in touch with your breathing. Let it be your friend. Let it be your companion. Let it be your teacher. Let it be your support. Breathing in and breathing out with awareness. So, I see there are some questions downstairs, and Richard will take them tonight, and then there'll be a sign-up sheet on the door downstairs. We posted downstairs the times through your meeting with Richard and I. So tomorrow, rather than posting your names and times, it's a sign-up sheet. So those of you who'd like to meet with one of us can sign up there. We've set up the morning full roster of times. And hopefully it's enough for the people who want to meet with us. If it isn't, we'll try to add more times in the afternoon. I think that's what... So let's take, you've been sitting for a long time. Let's take 30 seconds to compose yourself again. Close, get back into your retreat mode, your practice mode.